This is the audio portion that accompanies the E.T. Brown Drug versus Coco Care Products case. This is our first introduction into trademark law. Trademark law is kind of fun because everyone is a consumer, right? Maybe less so now than we were before, particularly if we're talking about goods in grocery stores. But it makes it, to me at least, very accessible to think about what consumers think, what we're trying to protect, how consumers perceive certain things. And so the first slide is this theory about trademark law. And in some ways, trademark law arguably shouldn't even be a part of a IP fundamentals course because trademark finds its foundation actually not in the patent and copyright clause in the United States Constitution, but actually under the Commerce Clause. And that's how we have a federal level. The other thing, and this is a little bit back to with trade secret law, is that we have this idea of both federal and state trademarks, although we'll mainly be talking about federal trademark law, and that's where most of the action is. The other reason that this is not thought of as an area of intellectual property law is more seen as a fair competition or unfair competition regulatory area of law. Because the theory is the reason we're going to provide exclusivity for trademarks, these are things that identify a good or services source, is not to protect the producer of the good, like we would see with maybe, say, patent law or copyright law, but more so to protect the consumer. That is, that the consumer has certain amount of information they've put into this mark from their experience, from advertising that they've seen, from what others have said about the underlying good or service. And so consumers have this information embedded in the mark. And so here it's the idea of Coca-Cola, right? If I see that mark on a particular type of good, particularly a brown beverage, I'm already have a lot of information about the product, probably what it tastes like, what other people think about the product, maybe even the image of the types of people who have that product, etc. And so the fact that just that brand or that kind of source identifier is enough to provide all of that information, we want to protect consumers' ability to rely on that information. That is, every good out there that is marked with that trademark or that source identifier, Coca-Cola, is going to be coming from the same source. And so I always know either who to blame if the thing doesn't taste like I think it tastes like. But also, it means that I don't have to go down the aisle and open up every one of these things marked Coca-Cola and say, okay, well, what exactly does this taste like? I can kind of rely on the idea that the person selling the product wants for me to have a consistent, high-quality experience with the underlying good. And so the theory here is that by protecting consumers, by making sure that only one person uses that mark if it's an identifier of a good or services single source, that lowers consumers' information costs, makes it much easier for me to make decisions and rely on previous information that's there. And we're going to do this odd thing where instead of having the consumer be the one who's going to sue because of this mistake, and if somebody else uses the mark Coca-Cola on a product that doesn't come from the Coca-Cola source but from somewhere else, and that starts to harm consumers because their experiences are not the same, etc., we're going to put the enforcement in the hand on the trademark holder's hands. That means Coca-Cola, the company, can sue people that might be trying to use the same mark and confuse consumers and ruin these information cost benefits. But it's not that Coca-Cola is doing it on its behalf. It's suing on behalf of consumers. And so trademark law then allows us to go around and rely on these marks as source identifiers. This makes it easier and quicker for us to buy products. Then if you go to the next slide, the other thing that it's going to do is allow us to look at goods in different contexts, maybe when the good's not there in front of us. So there it's the little identifier of all detergent on Amazon, where I can look at it and I can basically rely on this mark all as an identifier for a specific detergent that comes from a single source. And this then makes sure and protects consumers that they can feel comfortable as to what they're providing and getting from that source. The other theory here is if we're going to lock a single mark coming from a single source for a good or service, this then incentivizes the person who makes Coca-Cola or the person who makes all the single source to invest in the product's quality, because they're either going to live and die by this Marx association with the underlying product. So the information not only lowers consumer costs, but it actually improves, at least in theory, improves the product's quality, because now that I know as a producer I'm the sole person out there with the Mark Coca-Cola or the sole person out there with the Mark All on detergent or a beverage of some kind, I'm incentivized to invest in making a quality product, because that qualities, the experiences that consumers have, are going to kind of come back to me as the producer of that underlying good. And so this also actually is supposed to trademark exclusivity, the idea that one person can use that mark to identify those goods and services, will incentivize people to invest in quality and actually spout off that quality, right? So this then incentivizes the idea that I may have advertisements because I want to incentivize people to come use my product because I'm going to say it has certain types of features, etc. And so this is the way trademark law also benefits consumers. If you go to the third slide, though, there is some theory, and this is the more kind of modern theory of trademark law, and we'll talk about this particularly when we get to protection for inherently distinctive marks and the concept of dilution, that it can take on an intellectual property type of bent because it can incentivize the investment in the brand itself or the mark itself. And we see this a lot, right? We can think a lot about a lot of products where it's not as much what the actual underlying product tastes like or how it works, but it's the status that comes along with the brand, right? So this is a brand that's fun. This is a brand that rich people have. This is a brand that identifies you as someone who's cool. And so the other theory here is that trademark law incentivizes the development of brands, and we can consider and can muse on the idea as to whether we actually think brands themselves are socially beneficial or not. And so here we have Kellogg's Bat Bites. We can only take a gander that this probably is a terrible tasting cereal. We can think of better cereals than Kellogg's Bat Bites. But why would someone want to buy Bat Bites? Because they would like to have breakfast with Batman. And so the use of the mark Batman to identify a cereal product probably doesn't say much about its quality. In some ways, maybe it gives us the opposite part about its quality. But what it actually will do, though, and this probably provides some utility, I'll admit it, I'm this way with some products as well. I really want to have breakfast with Batman. I really believe you can't fight crime without a good breakfast, particularly a Batman breakfast. And so it makes me feel good that I'm eating a breakfast that's associated with a brand that has a certain nostalgia or identity to it. And this is another theory as to why we provide exclusivity for trademarks, is to incentivize the mark holders, that is the single sources that are providing products identified by the brand, to invest in those brands and make those brands bigger and develop them and advertise them in ways in which at least those who consume them want them to be associated with. So this is another theory of trademark law, less about protecting consumers, incentivizing lower search costs, improving quality in the product, but also creating brands that for some reason we might think have some kind of social utility. And so the question becomes, we've talked about this with every type of area of intellectual property law that we've taken a look at, is, okay, well, how do I get a protectable trademark? And so that's slide four. There really are three requirements. The big one is that we only provide protection for marks that are distinctive. Basically, that they're capable of identifying the goods or services single source, where those goods come from, or maybe where those goods are licensed from. The other thing we're going to find out is that to get trademark protection, I actually have to use the identified goods or service in commerce. This makes sense because the foundation for ability for the federal government to regulate this area is the Commerce Clause. But the other reason we might have a use in commerce requirement is because we're trying to actually protect consumers. And if you're not using the mark in commerce, well, then how are we concerned about consumers' information costs or how they're consuming the actual mark and what they think about it? If you're not using it in commerce, then there's no kind of commerce to worry about being unfairly used in competition or hurting consumers, etc. We're going to find that this gets relaxed a little bit when we talk about trademark registration, particularly as we've moved more and more toward looking at trademarks more as a property right. Someone
comes up with a distinctive trademark. And maybe we might relax the use in commerce requirement a little bit. And finally, we've got a priority requirement. We only provide trademark protection to the senior user. So you're going to hear me talk sometimes about the senior user and junior user. The senior user is the one who first uses the mark in commerce to identify that good or service. And our theory here is then that's what the consumers are associating the mark with, and they'll get priority over junior users. There's a geographical element to trademarks. It might turn out that seniority varies, right, depending on whether we're in a certain part of the country or the other. This geographical nature of marks has changed a lot over the years as we've become more of a, at least a national brand type of commerce and industry, and we can even think about this on the international level. And finally, if we meet all three of these, we've got something that's a valid trademark. We've been using that validity terminology a lot throughout the course. We can also say that's trademarkable, in some ways remarkable. And so going to slide five, right, we can take a look at the Lanham Act, which is section 45 of the Lanham Act, which defines what a mark is. It can be a lot of different things. It can be a trademark, identify something that's in trade. It can be a product. It can be a service mark, identify services. It can identify a collective, or it can actually also be a certification mark. And so when you hear the Lanham Act is the relative citation in 15 U.S.C., It actually turns out that the 15 U.S.C. Lanham Act starts at 15 U.S.C. 1051. But what you'll hear is people referring to the Lanham Act in the relative terms, not in the absolute terms of where they appear in 15 U.S.C., but where they are in parts of the Lanham Act. They're the parts that deal with trademark law and unfair competition and false advertising. 15 U.S.C. deals with a lot of other stuff as well. But the Lanham Act is what we're focused on, and that's where we'll see these kind of aspects of this. And so if we take a look at section 45, right, there's this identifier of, okay, what can be a trademark? And I'll use the term mark as a broader context. And we're going to basically protect anything that's a source identifier. That is, that can identify that a good or service comes from a single source. And we can kind of get in this further if you go to slide six, and the definition of trademark is something, a word, name, symbol, or device, and we eventually talk about this in Qualtext, we'll find out it can be anything that's used by someone, the person could be a corporation, in commerce to identify his or her good, so it's a trademark. And so the E.T. Brown Drug versus Cocoa Care case gives us an example of trademarks, and it's going to give us the example of trademarks in the context of an actual trademark infringement litigation. And so if you're on slide seven, essentially the allegation by Palmer's Cocoa Butter Formula is that Cocoa Care's product, also named Cocoa Butter Formula, is likely to cause consumers to be confused as to the source of the Cocoa Care product. They might think that the source for the Cocoa Care product is the same as the Palmer source, and Palmer's trying to use the trademark, and so here it's a mark, it's a word mark, these words, Cocoa Butter Formula, to say, no, I am the exclusive provider of goods, the underlying good is a cocoa butter lotion, that's identified as Cocoa Butter Formula. And before we get into the question of whether there's trademark infringement, which we'll talk about here shortly, we first have to have a protectable trademark. So this is the same as we saw with copyright law, where we took an early look and we were looking at validity. We were actually looking at questions about validity, right? Does Selden have a protection over the forms and double entry bookkeeping accounting? Does the Kansas Rural Telephone Company have protection over their alphabetical listing of telephone numbers? But they're in the form of in the context of a trademark litigation. And so the mark that Palmer's is claiming to have exclusivity over is Cocoa Butter Formula. And with all these cases, we don't only care about the mark, we also care about, okay, well, what is the good or service that's supposed to be being identified by the mark? And here, the good or service that's supposed to be identified by the mark is a cocoa butter lotion. And so Palmer's is saying, look, I should be able to get protection for the mark Cocoa Butter Formula to identify a cocoa butter lotion. And Cocoa Care's argument is, no, actually, you don't have a protectable mark. Cocoa Butter Formula is not distinctive. And distinctiveness is one of our first big requirements for trademark protection. So if we go to slide eight, we'll see this spectrum of distinctiveness. This is judicially created, and we'll be talking about this a decent amount. This is the big requirement for protection under trademark law. And we've got this spectrum of distinctiveness that starts from the least distinctive and actually an area in which it can never be distinctive, going all the way to some areas of distinctiveness where it is always going to be distinctive. It'll be inherently distinctive unless it becomes generic, which we'll talk about here in just a second. And so the degree of distinctiveness is decreasing as I go from right to left if I'm looking at this. And right now you're looking at examples of different types of marks of different categories. The one thing about showing this as a PDF is that we end up having kind of blocked off the different categories of distinctiveness. And so let me start on the far right. These are ones that are inherently distinctive. The theory here is that these marks will be determined to be distinctive just because they're so disassociated and undescriptive of the underlying goods or services that they're being used on. The furthest of the kind of types of marks that are inherently distinctive are arbitrary and fanciful marks. Arbitrary and fanciful marks. And so here we have the mark Exxon for the good or service, which would either be gasoline or a gas station. And the word Exxon is completely arbitrary or fanciful for the underlying good or service, gasoline or filling up stations, gas stations. No relationship at all. Doesn't describe it. Actually, quite frankly, is a completely made up term. And these, we say, are inherently distinctive, essentially inherently unique, because the consumer does not have any preconceived notions as to, when I say the word Exxon, anything about gasoline or gas stations. Now, clearly you do now, because it's been used in commerce, and they've done a really good job of associating that mark with those underlying goods and services. But before its introduction, it was inherently distinction. It was arbitrary and fanciful. The other category, as we move from right to left, is suggestive marks. Suggestive marks. These are still determined to be inherently distinctive, but they're a little bit closer to being suggestive of the underlying good or service. And so here we have the mark Coppertone. Coppertone is considered to be suggestive of the underlying good or service, a sunscreen lotion as opposed to a suntan lotion. Why is it suggestive? It's suggestive because the theory being is that if I use copper tone, I might get a copper tone, right? Not a beet red, let's say. Although nowadays, if I use copper tone, I guess I'm supposed to still stay completely pasty white, if that's the beginning nature of your skin before you put it on. And we'll talk about this in the context of the E.T. Brown case, but suggestive marks are one where we have to take a couple of imaginative steps to get from copper tone eventually to the underlying identified good or service, sunscreen lotion. We get there. It's closer than Exxon. It's not arbitrary and fanciful, but it's just merely suggestive. Those are inherently distinctive. They get protection out of the gate. We're just going to assume that consumers will uniquely identify them, those marks, with the goods or services underlying them. Then there's this other category. Can you actually acquire distinctiveness? And these are descriptive marks. These are ones where I actually have to prove that the consumers out there are starting to associate the mark with that good or service. It needs to have some type of secondary meaning. We're not going to provide protection out of the gate. You're going to have to actually prove that consumers are starting to associate your mark with those underlying goods or services. And these are marks that actually describe the goods or services. And so Investacorp, I will leave this up to you to determine what you think the underlying goods and services are. It's a company that provides you investment services. We say that's descriptive. It can acquire distinctiveness, but through secondary meaning. We'll talk about secondary meaning here in just a second in E.T. Brown. This is this idea that we need to actually have some push for some protectability, where we assume that consumers now, instead of thinking it in a descriptive nature, actually primarily see it as a source identifier. Finally, in our far left category, we have generic marks, and these are ones that can never be distinctive. They define a whole category of goods or services. And so here's shredded wheat for, guess what, shredded wheat. These can never be protectable because our assumption here is that consumers need them to identify whole categories or classes of goods, genuses of goods, as they talk about in the E.T. Brown case. And so these are never protectable. It doesn't matter. You can't acquire secondary meaning. Essentially, competitive, fair competition requires everyone to be able to use that mark to determine what those underlying goods or services are. And so that's our spectrum of distinctiveness. We go from inherently distinctive, arbitrary and fanciful or suggestive, protectable out of the gate, Two, you got to acquire distinctiveness, use secondary meaning for those descriptive marks, and finally, this category of genericness where we will never have protection for those particular ones. And so now I'm going to split this up in two. We've gone about 19 minutes, and then we'll start talking about E.T. Brown here in just a second.